If you have a moment, we'd like to introduce you to the odd couple of American agriculture, Gene Gregory and Wayne Pacelli.
We were adversaries, and some might say bitter adversaries.
That's Wayne Pacelli, who is president of the Humane Society of the United States, which says it wants to end factory farming. His former adversary, Gene Gregory, represents some of the factory farmers, America's largest egg producers. He used to say, "I'm not interested in talking to Wayne Pacelli."
Why would you want to have a conversation with someone that wants to eliminate your business?
But now they're not just having a conversation. They're allies, walking shoulder to shoulder into offices on Capitol Hill and asking Congress to approve new rules for egg farmers. NPR's Dan Charles explains.
Wayne Pacelli and Gene Gregory had a meeting in Washington, D.C. this past Tuesday. They came to it, though, from different worlds. Pacelli, the Humane Society president, woke up in a trendy part of the nation's capital, and for breakfast, he had a very berry smoothie with soy milk. No ham, no eggs, as always.
I made a decision a long time ago that I was not going to consume animal products because I was really concerned about what's going on in factory farms.
Gene Gregory lives in Georgia, in the suburbs outside Atlanta. He got up really early so he could catch his flight to Washington.
My wife keeps hard-boiled eggs in the refrigerator, so I had a hard-boiled egg and a glass of juice before I left the house.
Of course he'd eat eggs.
I've been connected with the egg industry now for about 50 years.
Gregory used to run an egg farm. Now he's president of the United Egg Producers, a trade organization. And Wayne Pacelli at the Humane Society of the United States has been a fierce critic of that industry, specifically its system of crowding chickens into long lines of wire cages, hundreds of thousands of birds in a single chicken house.
I said that these factory farms are cruel and inhumane, no question about that. We're passionate about this issue. We want to see changes within this industry.
Over the past decade, Pacelli's organization and Gregory's spent millions of dollars fighting over proposals to ban the cages. And then last summer, they did something unexpected. Gregory sent a message through an intermediary. "Can the two of us just talk?" And Pacelli, from the Humane Society, saw an opportunity.
We could fight the United Egg Producers for another 10 or 15 years and spend millions and millions of dollars on both sides. But the other option is we could sit down together and figure out a pathway that's good for the industry and better for animals.
This is what they came up with. Farmers could still keep their chickens in cages, but the chickens would get more space, twice as much, plus perches and places to lay their eggs. This all would be phased in over 15 years. Gregory says the phase-in has been planned really carefully.
To make sure that we always have a sufficient supply of eggs to meet the market needs at a fair price.
The hitch is Congress has to write this deal into law so that everybody follows these rules.
Hello.
Congress, very nice to meet you.
Which is why these former adversaries are now making joint lobbying visits to Capitol Hill.
Good to see you. How are you?
Good.
This visit is to a supporter, Democratic Congressman Kurt Schrader of Oregon. For both Gregory and Pacelli, there's a calculation behind this joint venture. For the egg producers, it's a lot better than the growing patchwork of state regulations they were already facing. And for the Humane Society, it's a way to reach farms in a lot of states that weren't likely to regulate the egg industry at all. But for these two men, there's now something more than calculation involved. Maybe not friendship exactly, but respect. Gene Gregory says, "I was wrong about Wayne Pacelli.
I found him to be a man of his word, and it doesn't have to be his way or no way. And it's not that he's trying to eliminate our business or anybody in animal agriculture. He just wants to see improvements made."
Wayne Pacelli, for his part, says, "Gene Gregory's helped me understand the pressures involved in trying to make a living producing food."
You know, about the daily struggles that a lot of the farmers go through economically. They were kind of in a race with others in a competitive environment to build efficiencies, and this is how it went.
These former adversaries will need each other to get their proposal approved. It's an unusual plan, as unconventional as the partnership that hatched it. No one knows whether Congress will find that appealing or suspect. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Now, for all the controversy over this policy, it turns out that a similar requirement has existed for years, and it's already been tested in court. NPR's Julie Robner has more.
One of the things that has most frustrated backers of the birth control mandate is that the requirement itself is not so new. Sarah Lipton-Lubit of the ACLU says the only really new part is that for the first time, women won't have to pay a deductible or copayment before they can get contraceptives.
But as a legal matter, a constitutional matter, it's completely unremarkable.
What gave contraceptive coverage its first big boost was a ruling by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission back in December of the year 2000. Two nurses had filed a complaint because their health plan covered other preventive services, but not birth control. In that ruling, the EEOC found that a 1978 law, the Pregnancy Disability Act, or PDA, prevents discrimination in the provision of birth control used to prevent pregnancy, says Peggy Mastroianni, EEOC's general counsel.
That the PDA covers not only people who are pregnant, but also discrimination based on the ability to become pregnant or potential for pregnancy.
Back in 2000, the EEOC also looked at whether failing to cover contraception when it's used for medical reasons, not to prevent pregnancy, violated Title VII of the U.S. Civil Rights Act.
And under that analysis, because these prescription contraceptives are available only for women, everybody who is affected by their exclusion is female, and that is simply straightforward Title VII sex discrimination.
The EEOC ruling, though not technically legally binding on every employer, had an immediate effect. It was cited in lawsuits and helped accelerate the trend of states passing their own laws requiring contraceptive coverage. Today, 28 states have such laws. Several of those states have no exceptions at all for religious employers, but several do. And in many cases, those exceptions look a lot like the one in the rule issued by the Department of Health and Human Services last month. The ACLU's Lipton-Lubit says that's no coincidence.
The HHS rule was modeled on the exceptions in several state laws, including California, New York, Oregon.
Specifically, those states and the new federal rule exempt religious organizations that have as their primary purpose, quote, the inculcation of religious values and who primarily employ and serve people of that religion. That means in practice that churches, synagogues, mosques, and other houses of worship are exempt, but religious hospitals, universities, and social service agencies are not. And while lawsuits are now being filed, they're not the first to challenge that distinction. Lipton-Lubit says the social service agency Catholic Charities sued in both California and New York in 2004 and 2006, respectively.
In both the California and New York cases, Catholic Charities made arguments very similar to the ones that are being made now with respect to the HHS rule.
That would be that requiring them to include contraception in their health plans would force them to violate their religious beliefs.
Those arguments failed in that litigation, and they're no more persuasive here.
And in both states, she says, the cases got to each state's highest court, where justices resoundingly found in favor of the contraceptive requirement and against the idea that it was an infringement of religious liberty.
In fact, the litigation in New York was appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided we don't need to hear that case.
But opponents have said when the federal government acts, it's a whole new legal ballgame, and as we've seen, certainly a whole new political one. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
So here's where we stand this morning. As reported by our colleague Scott Horsley, President Obama is about an hour away from announcing a change in his policy on contraception. The new policy will be that women working for religious institutions can still get contraception for free, but they would get it directly from their insurance companies without involving the church. We will bring you a reaction to that change as we learn it on NPR News. It pretty much goes without saying that Star Wars fans can be obsessive. That's the whole point. Some keep toys in their original plastic packaging. Others collect merchandise or may have a Han Solo in carbonite standing in their living room. This weekend, George Lucas hopes fans will buy tickets for a new 3D version of The Phantom Menace. From member station KPBS, Beth Accomando explains how one obsessed fan was inspired to make his own Star Wars films.
Blame Jar Jar Binks.
No, no, Mrs. Stay. Missy called Jar Jar Binks. Missy, your humble servant.
When The Phantom Menace first came out in 1999, the annoying, slapstick-prone, computer-generated Jar Jar Binks became the focus of fan hatred and ridicule.
Ye gods! What did Missy say?
Missy saying Jar Jar should have his Gungan tongue cut out. Jar Jar came to symbolize what fans saw as Lucas's flawed creative judgment. One fan was so incensed that he recut the movie to reduce Jar Jar's on-screen time. It came to be known as the Phantom Edit and gave Star Wars geek Jamie Benning his first taste of fan filmmaking.
I think when the Phantom Edit first came out of The Phantom Menace, where the editor tried to remove a lot of the silliness and Jar Jar Binks from the movie, I think a lot of people realised that the ability for people to do that kind of thing had finally arrived.
Then in 2006, Benning joined an online group petitioning Lucas to release the Star Wars trilogy in its original form. You know, the one where Han, not that bounty hunter Greedo, shot first. Lucas ignored their pleas. So Benning, a professional editor and full-time Star Wars nerd, took matters into his own hands and created a fan film. Benning's films are unofficial documentaries. He uses footage from the original movies without permission from Lucas. Benning follows the flow of the original films, but expands them with things like alternate takes and interviews from commentary tracks. Take this sequence where Benning edits audio from a Star Wars radio drama over footage of deleted scenes.
There's two ships out there, all right. Come on, Treadwell, get yourself over to the Lambs, Peter. I've got to get into Anchorhead and tell Fixer about this. Well, get it in gear, will ya?
On-screen text explains that the grainy black and white images come from what's known as the lost cut.
Jamie Benning's Star Wars documentaries are like DVD extras, squared or even cubed.
Francine Stock is presenter of BBC4's The Film Programme.
They're amateur in the true sense of being made by someone who really loves his subject.
But professional in terms of the craft. Benning calls them filmumentaries and has spent close to a year on each. He makes no money on any of the films because of copyright issues. But Stock says this isn't a hobby. It's a calling.
They're more of a compulsion. And indeed, they stand or fall on their energy and style.
You could call them a total geek fix.
When I made Star Wars Begins and put that on YouTube, it just seemed to touch a chord with people. I think people had become disillusioned with the Star Wars franchise being spread too thin, certainly people of my age.
Benning's trilogy got more than 3 million views on YouTube. But just recently, the site requested he remove the films. Benning has now uploaded them to Vimeo. Fan films like his place studios in a quandary. Legally, they feel an obligation to defend their copyright. But from a promotions perspective, they see how fan films generate and maintain interest in their products in ways that no amount of money can buy. Benning's latest fan doc is called Raiding the Lost Ark. It focuses on the first Lucas-produced, Steven Spielberg-directed Indiana Jones film. And it serves up another slice of geek heaven. For NPR News, I'm Beth Accomando.
Next, we'll meet a playwright who's been thinking about one of the more dramatic stories in Africa in the 19th century. It was the white colonization of the country that was, for a time, known as Rhodesia. The playwright turned that history into a visceral new play, now on stage in Princeton, New Jersey. Whether you're ever able to see The Convert or not, it is worth hearing the story of its author. Here's Jeff London.
Playwright Denai Gurira sometimes refers to herself as Zimmerican. While she was born in Iowa, she spent most of her childhood in her parents' home city, Harare, Zimbabwe. It's where her new play is set.
I grew up there from age 5 to 19. I'm back there every year. But I feel like there are things that I had to dig out through this process of creating this play that for some reason I wasn't exposed to a lot, just in terms of how, you know, I was educated. I was educated very much in a neo-colonial way, honestly.
Gurira says The Convert is the first play in a series she hopes to write about Zimbabwe through the eyes of the people whose lives were transformed by colonialism.
I was thinking one day and I was like, I want to make a play that's sort of like an adaptation of Pygmalion about Zimbabwe, because I just feel like there's so many parallel themes. And that's really where it was born from. And then it just took its own route.
In Pygmalion, Henry Higgins takes a poor flower girl named Eliza Doolittle and teaches her to speak the king's English. In The Convert, a young woman from the Shona tribe, Jekasai, runs away from an arranged marriage and is taken under the wing of a black Catholic missionary named Chilford.
Well, the first of things that must be done is that name must be changed. You need a name that expresses a Christian faith. Mary, mother of Jesus, is the most blessed name. But I just need another girl this afternoon. There's Ruth. But I hate names of monosyllables. So, Esther.
Guerrera uses her own family history in the play. Her great-great-aunt became a nun, fleeing a forced betrothal. Director Emily Mann says this was a common occurrence in Rhodesia in the late 19th century, when the play is set.
There were many, many women who ran to the church. Some of them became nuns, some of them became teachers, basically so that they could be free. You know, women were often fleeing being sold off in a way or being given away without their own permission to a man to be, you know, could be, as in this play, the 10th wife of an old man.
And Jekesai, or Esther as she's christened, adapts quickly to her new situation. Pascal Armand plays the teenage girl.
She's learned a whole new language. She's learned about a whole new religion, which she has put complete and utter faith in, like puts her life into this new way of thinking and new way of believing.
Leading her in this transformation is Chilford, who has renounced his own family and tribal traditions. And while his deepest desire is to become a priest, few black Africans were ordained in those days. He's a decent and well-meaning man, playwright Denai Guerrera says, but...
he's a casualty, one could say, of the issue of colonization in the sense that he really drinks all the Kool-Aid, like every last drop of it, really embracing hook, line, sinker, the idea that a Christian God is very intertwined with a white man.
The gap between doctrine and reality, black and white, causes the characters to be twisted like pretzels. For instance, Chilford is furious at Esther for correcting a white priest in church. But actress Pascal Armand says the village girl doesn't understand why she has to defer.
I have no understanding of racism. This is my first introduction to that term, to that ideology that I now have to deal with and be subservient to, and no.
You told me that we must never be in the tolerance of a misquoting of the Bible in our presence.
Yes,
you told me that under that circumstance we must be quick to correct, to be of certainty that the Lord's word is never in distortion. That is what I am in belief that I did.
Yes, but not to Father Bart.
May I be asking why?
Why? Is it not in the obvious? He is a white.
He is?
So you may never correct him.
While white characters are discussed on stage, the convert is told entirely from the black viewpoint. In an early draft of the play, Guerrera says she attempted to write a scene with Chilford's white mentor.
I actually tried. I tried to put him on the stage. And I was like, no, it's going to be an absolute caricature. I'm not going to be able... And it didn't make sense. It just didn't make sense. I was like, this is going to be the play from the colonized perspective.
The tensions in the society erupt, and in the second act, the audience finds out that Chilford's mentor has been killed. And as the convert unfolds in highly intense fashion over the course of 3 hours, it becomes clear that, unlike Shaw's Pygmalion, this is a tragedy. Blood will be spilled. Lives will be ruined. Director Emily Mann.
You begin to understand from the colonized what colonialism really is. And because Denai is too smart to make it one person's right and one person's wrong or black and white in any way, she's so interested in gray areas. She's so interested in how messy human beings really are.
Things are not good, brother.
What happened to your head, man? I have a seat, man.
The rebellion, it has spread. It is now setting to us here. In Mashona land.
Mashona? Never! They are too docile. That cannot be of truth.
It is. The first family was already slaughtered.
Even though The Convert is set in the late 19th century, Denai Guerrera thinks it has relevance to the problems of contemporary Africa.
What dynamics of our traditions do we retain, and what are we retaining only because we got colonized? And so there was this huge, you know, stop gap that happened in terms of how we were taken over and we were not able to evolve in our own way, in our own time.
The Convert finishes its run in Princeton this Sunday. It then moves on to the Goodman Theater in Chicago and the Center Theater Group in Los Angeles. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
From NPR News, it's Morning Edition. Our engineering supervisor is Kevin Langley. Our technical director is Kurt Stoniker. Audio engineers include Stacey Abbott, who's at the controls as I speak, Brian Jarbo, Vince Muse, Greg Gavin, Dennis Nielsen, Sean Phillips, Nathan Bark, William Plummer, and Burke Hun, with Theo Mondel at NPR West. Our executive producer is Madalika Sicka. The executive editor of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Our theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Gray wolves have been taken off the endangered species list in several western states. That means their populations have recovered. But complications continue in Wyoming. Wolves there are still federally protected because the state has been aggressive about wanting to kill them. Now, Wyoming has finally struck a deal with the federal government for how wolves will be treated once they come off the list. As NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports, environmentalists say the deal does not go far enough.
There weren't any wolves in Wyoming until the federal government reintroduced them in the 1990s. Now there are at least 329. The state is eager to shrink the population because wolves kill livestock and game. Joe Tilden is a county commissioner in Wyoming and the founder of a hunting advocacy group.
My personal opinion is that they need to be hunted wherever and whenever they occur because wolves are extremely secretive type creatures. They're extremely intelligent.
Under the New Deal, wolves in the northwestern part of Wyoming could be managed as trophy animals, unless they're in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. But conservationists worry hunting will be allowed on a stretch of national park that connects Yellowstone to Grand Teton. It's called the J.D. Rockefeller Parkway.
Wolves use that area extensively, traveling between the two parks, and it's a very wild area.
Sharon Mader represents the National Parks Conservation Association. She says this corridor is essential for maintaining viable populations.
Unique and iconic wildlife such as wolves that are just coming off the endangered species list deserve the ultimate protection that national parks offer.
She says it's especially important for the parks to provide this sanctuary for wolves in Wyoming because they will be hunted on other federal lands there. If they wander out of the state's northwest corner, they will be considered predators and could be shot on sight. The National Park Service is against hunting wolves on the J.D. Rockefeller Parkway, too.
Visitors come to Yellowstone, they come to Tetons, they come to the parkway just to see wolves. And so we want to manage the park so that people can enjoy wildlife viewing.
Herbert Frost is an associate director of the Park Service. He says his agency has the authority to ban wolf hunts on park land, but he's not picking that fight with the state yet.
We haven't ceded anything. We're just working with the state so that we can work together as opposed to working at odds with each other.
Most national parks forbid hunting, but the legislation creating the J.D. Rockefeller Parkway allows for some hunting. Scott Talbot heads the Wyoming Department of Game and Fish. His agency manages hunts of other animals on the J.D. Rockefeller Parkway, and Talbot wants to keep his options open to hold wolf hunts there, too.
As we move forward, it may be fairly important for the department to move forward with wolf hunting in the JDR.
For instance, if the population gets out of hand, hunters like Joe Tilden may be needed.
When you're hunting a predator, you're not only out to enjoy the sport, but you're also out to control the number of predators.
The wolf in Wyoming is expected to come off the endangered species list by early autumn. Conservationists hope there's a hunting ban in the J.D. Rockefeller Parkway by then. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
Now, the Arab Awakening is just one of many events that President Obama's administration has to monitor in a changing world. The administration is also shifting emphasis toward the Asia-Pacific region, which is why the first company of U.S. Marines arrive in northern Australia in April. They'll open a training facility as the U.S. replaces bases that closed years ago in the Philippines. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Australians call their northernmost latitude the Top End. The territorial capital of Darwin, just across the Timor Sea from Indonesia, feels as much a part of the vibrant Asia-Pacific as it does the Australian continent. It's a rowdy frontier town, popular with bushmen, backpackers, and off-duty soldiers. The first 250 Marines will arrive in 2 months, with the troop numbers eventually ramping up to 2,500. An Air Force contingent is expected to follow. They'll come here to an Australian Army outpost called Robertson Barracks, where cockatoos perch in the trees, the odd pack of dingoes follows joggers, and buff cavalrymen walk the grounds with an emu feather tucked in their slouch hats. The commanding officer is Brigadier Gus McLaughlin.
I think the most significant feature of what's on offer for the Marines here is space. The range that we will make available for them to use most specifically is a range called the Bradshaw Range. It's as big as the state of Connecticut.
For the Marines, it will be one of the largest combined arms training facilities in the world, meaning they can fire live ammunition, lob artillery shells, and strafe targets from aloft without bothering the neighbors. As the Brigadier says,
I've got to tell you, out there, no one can hear scream.
And there is, in the outback of the Top End, plenty to scream about.
Down where the Marines will do a lot of their training at the Bradshaw Range, there's probably a man-eating crocodile about every 200 metres in the river. We have, I think, at least half of the top 10 venomous snakes in the world, are probably roaming freely around that range. So it is a tough, demanding place to train.
Marine Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Puglisi is in charge of the forward advance team at Robertson Barracks. He thinks when the Corps asks for volunteers, many hands will go up.
I think when they hear Australia, it's going to excite them. It's something new. I know if I was a young Marine, I'd be pretty excited about going to Australia to train.
And when they hear about the humidity and the crocs and the snakes?
Nah, they're tough. The environment will present some challenges, and any Marine looks forward to those challenges.
Australia and the United States share an enduring military alliance. Aussies have fought alongside Americans in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, Iraq, and currently Afghanistan. No Australian city understands the responsibility of hosting Allied forces better than Darwin.
On February the 19th, 1942, radio messages were received in Darwin from the Catholic mission on Bathurst Island, warning that over 100 aircraft were heading towards Darwin.
A film inside the military museum recounts the Japanese bombing of Darwin. The attack crippled the Australian Navy and sunk or damaged Allied warships anchored in the harbor. The U.S. Navy destroyer, the Peary, which lost 89 sailors, rests on the ocean floor to this day. Darwin has already had experience with the U.S. military, between Marines who come here on joint exercises and U.S. Navy ships that call at the port. Off-duty, the servicemen usually head straight for the pubs on Mitchell Street. A Darwin lawyer, who gives her name as Ruth, is leery.
I think that people worry, women worry about sexual assault, so I think there's a certain public safety concern.
According to local news, Marines have been involved in some drunken brawls, and a sailor was charged with rape, but the case was later dropped. Darwin Lord Mayor Graham Sawyer says troops, both U.S. and Australian, will misbehave, but he's not overly concerned.
American troops seem to fit in fairly well, and I think American and Australian cultures match each other to a fair degree. So I think it'll all work pretty well.
Regional neighbors are a different matter. Both China and Indonesia voiced concern over the U.S. military buildup, worried that a closer American-Australian bond might come at their expense. John Burnett, NPR News, Darwin, Australia.